We have Dr. Jack Kilcrease on the program today, and we discuss postmodernism and its effects on politics, economics, and culture, as well as religion. This is Matthew Garnett. Welcome to In Layman's Terms.
So for him, then that translates into a social system where an authority above doesn't somehow violently, let's say, impose order on people. Rather, if you leave people to themselves, essentially, and their relationships are not hampered by sin, that they'll simply participate in the common reality of their society.
It's better than the way it's being run.
All right, so at long last, I've got somebody on the program to sort of debate with. It was a nice discussion I had with Dr. Kilcrease. Didn't really turn into a debate per se. We got a bit of a differing approach on the usefulness of postmodern philosophy and that sort of thing. From what I've read of him, there's some tools that the postmoderns use that can be useful to Christianity as well. And in a sense, I agree. One thing that often these sort of debates boil down to is recognizing problems. And one thing postmodernism does a very good job of is recognizing problems with modernism, with modernity, and identifying those problems, with which I agree. There are those problems. The thing is, what's the solution to those problems? So we're going to talk about all that, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But first, I want to talk to you about our Can You Well project. Met with the Kibos Hope Academy board. That was very gracious of them to have me come on board there. Hopefully, we're trying to figure out some way to get our podcast under their umbrella, so we're a nonprofit organization. So all that to say, let me just go ahead and announce that if you're a big donor out there and you're looking for a big write-off on taxes or something this year and you need a nonprofit to give to, you can give to our Well Project, and we can arrange it where you can deduct that from your taxes. If that's the case, if you're sitting on a pile of cash, you just need to offload for tax purposes, please let us know about that. Send me an email at discussion@laymanstermsradio.org, and we can make arrangements for that. So I just want to throw that out there. I don't know how many people are, in those type of situations that might listen to the podcast, but if you're one of those and you would like to donate to this project, please contact me because we can arrange. But that's one thing I found out from the board as well. They are seeking a nonprofit organization status, and what we're hoping is we can all kind of just lump together and we can work on this together, because there's other things we can work on besides the Well Project too. Once we get the well drilled, then there's a number of other things that we can get done there. But this is a big step. This is a big hump, this Well Project. And once we get that done, then we're hoping everything's going to be downhill from there. But at any rate, so just as a reminder for the rest of us who aren't sitting on piles of cash that need a tax deduction, $50, but that's what we need from each listener. We're getting there. We've raised a little over $1,200. Was hoping it would go a little bit faster, but we're really relaunch this thing again in the fall. But for now, just go ahead and give your $50, and we'll inch our way toward it, and we'll get there eventually. It's been my experience. I mean, just for me personally, I have to hear something over and over and over again before I finally decide to give to it and commit to it. And I understand that's probably what's going on. But just to kind of spur you along there, get off your duff and go ahead and make the commitment. Give the $50. Get it over with. I mean, it's a one-time thing. It's not like it's coming out of your account every month. But go ahead and make that commitment, and we're going to make a big difference there at the school there in Kenya, and help Monica and the Kibos Hope Academy folks out that way and break that cycle of poverty there in Kenya. They're so close in Kenya. It's really great. Which reminds me to remind you that if you're looking for arts and crafts, looking for a gift of some sort, go to our website, click on the Kenyan Christian Arts tab there. We've got a lot of wonderful art for sale there. I was just at a family reunion and brought some of the art there, and several people purchased art. It's great stuff, really nice, durable type of art, and very beautiful, high level of craftsmanship there. So please go ahead and go on our website and purchase some art from us. Direct from Kenya. So we've got those couple of things going on. Now we want to kind of get into this discussion that I had with Dr. Kilcrease. Dr. Kilcrease is a Lutheran layperson and an adjunct professor of theology at the Institute of Lutheran Theology and Aquinas College. He got his bachelor's in history and religion from Luther College, an MA in doctrine and theology from Luther Seminary in St. Paul, and he got his PhD in systematic theology from Marquette. So that's a little bit about Dr. Kilcrease, and if you just Google him, you can find out more if you'd like. So anyway, there's Dr. Kilcrease's little bit of vita for him. We're discussing John Milbank and also Stephen Hicks. Milbank is a theologian, Hicks is a philosopher, and these are kind of the two guys that that Dr. Kilcrease and I center around. So I'm going to play you a little bit of each so you can get a flavor for them. I'm not going to break in and describe terms here too much. Milbank is pretty heady. I may break in here and there. We'll see. I'm gonna just kind of let him play. But you kind of hopefully see where both of them are coming from. Essentially, you know, there's really two camps kind of in this philosophical debate that end up manifesting themselves politically. You've got one side of it who believes that socialism is the way forward, and the other side believes that liberal capitalism it really is the way forward. So that's kind of the two camps, and that really breaks down into kind of two philosophical camps, which are commonly known as objectivism, which is what Stephen Hicks is. And I've got my problems with objectivism, as you'll hear me talk about, you know, your Ayn Rand types, this sort of thing. And then you've got the postmoderns, really the post Enlightenment, the anti Enlightenment type folks, who are going to divide politically, culturally, socially, religiously, for a type of socialism. And hopefully you kind of hear that play out. And obviously, if you've listened to the podcast for any length of time, I'm going to fall more on the objectivist side. Although, again, I do have my problems with objectivists. I think they've got just as many problems as the postmoderns, probably not as many. The political systems that, in my opinion, that, well, not my opinion, I think it's objective fact that the political systems that have come out of what we might term as an objectivist or Enlightenment type philosophy have been, shall we say, much more safe for in which a human being can exist. The economic and social policies and practices that have come out of socialism have been murderous. Unfortunately, we see that with China and Russia, with communist socialism, that, you know, millions, estimate of 100 million between China and Russia, forget about North Korea, Venezuela, in the modern era, Cuba, how many people have been killed and how many people are suffering under these regimes. And then, of course, fascist socialism, which would be your Nazis. That's obviously, everybody agrees, was horrific and something that should not be tried again. So there's just the problem the socialists have is they've got very little evidence historically to support their case. And the liberals, that would be us. I mean, I'm speaking of liberalism in the classic sense. The liberal capitalists, you know, although capitalism and liberalism has its problems, it's messy, it's not perfectly clean, but compared to everything else, it's the best thing we've tried so far. And so I would vie to perfect that rather than abandon that project and try another socialism. However, you're going to hear Milbank in this lecture talk about a third socialism. Okay, and then we'll turn to Hicks and listen a little bit to some of the stuff he has to say, and then we'll get to the discussion between Dr. Kilcrease and I. Hopefully, this is helpful to you. And you'll hear Dr. Kilcrease and I talk about how this bears on the church, because this is very important stuff for us Christians to understand, I believe. It's been very helpful to me to understand why it is that the objectivist option is not an option. It's not an option. And why the postmodern option is not an option either. That you have to be a Christian. That's I learned that, I talk about being in the school of hard knocks a lot to you folks. This is it. This is what I had to learn. Get knocked around. Learn that, you know, learn that Christianity, Orthodox, traditional Christianity was the only way to go. It was the only way out of this mess. philosophically as well as other things. So let's get to it, and we're going to start with John Milbank and a lecture he gave at Oxford. Here we go.
So what I want finally to recommend is a third socialism, which would be a civil economy socialism, in the hope that David in heaven is agreeing with me. If socialism is exactly the right word, and maybe it isn't, that would be a socialism that would see the economy as fully part of civil society and would try to redesign the economic contract itself. It would be a socialism less inimical to the co-priority with production of exchange. A socialism indeed still suspicious or outlawing of usury in line with Thomas Aquinas, but also accepting, like Aquinas, and unlike most classic socialisms, that returns on shares are legitimate if real risks have been undergone and real responsibilities mutually shouldered. This would be a new mode of modern market, a still marketplace, but not technically a mode of modified capitalism, because any system of contract dominated by ethical justice rather than a machinic coordination of egotisms could no longer be a system in which the accumulation of capital rather than the general pursuit of human flourishing is the dominating factor. And I would want to define capitalism rather simply and naively, I think, in those terms. Such a third socialism, economic like the second socialism, but ethical like the first one, would bring, in the wake of Karl Polanyi's trajectory, Mosean perspectives on gift exchange as socially constitutive into dialogue with Marx's reflections on production and with Catholic social teaching's demand for a guiding architectonic justice in both the economic and the political spheres. I should say, the best of Anglican social teaching also. This returns us to the entire question of who can be the agents of such transformation in practice today and exactly how. I don't, of course, know of any full answer here, but I think that what the recent slogans of so-called post-liberalism in British politics, like Red Tory with Philip Blond, Blue Labour with Lord Glasman, The Big Society with David Cameron, Pre-Distribution and One Nation Labour with the Ed Miliband of a year ago, now sadly deceased, it seems. What these slogans are all groping towards is a new paradoxical fusion.
Okay, so there's a little bit of Milbank, and you can hear that entire lecture if you'd like. It's an hour long. It's called Associationism, Pluralism, and Post-Liberalism. Pretty fascinating stuff if you can track with what he's saying. But you see where he's coming from there. Just a kind of a revival of some sort of socialism. Now let's turn to Hicks and hear kind of his take on all of this.
So the Enlightenment, right, versus postmodernism, right? That's the battle we're fighting right now. These guys were young in the 50s, became mature in the 1960s, leading their professions, grand old men in the 70s and 1980s, right? Trained any number, right, of PhD students who themselves went on to be professors in the humanities, right, in the early the 90s, early 2000s, in our generation, right, so forth. Extraordinarily successful for the power of their political strategy and their ability to marshal the philosophical and epistemological arguments to support them. Now that's where we are, so the battle is joined, but I want to now turn in my concluding minutes here and be critical, right, of postmodernism. There are literally dozens of important philosophical issues that I'm not going to be able to talk about, obviously, that all of them need to be engaged. Right? There are good arguments for skepticism and good against, right? And so all of those issues that have led philosophers down varying paths have to be engaged, so I don't want to undermine the importance of any of those. But there are some things that we can say about the postmodern project, the postmodern claims, and about its assessment of the Enlightenment, especially. So, one thing that we are aware of, right, is this issue that postmodernists are, as a movement, right, not logically consistent. And there's a certain amount of traction and importance to pointing out the logical contradictions, right, that are made in postmodern. So on the one hand, if we say, right, that all truth is relative, right, that is an epistemological claim, right, that comes out of postmodernism. But at the same time, postmodernists will tell you that in some sense, their way of looking at things is the right way of looking at things. Right? That the other narratives need to be set aside, bracketed. So when we start talking about what gets into the curriculum, for example, the standard postmodern claim is not that there are all these other traditions, right, and they're all relative, and therefore they're all equal, and so we should teach them all. The agenda is, no, the postmodern one is the right way, and we're exerting all of our efforts to get rid of all of these other books that do not fit our postmodern canon. That's a contradiction, and it's worth calling them on it.
Okay, so there's a little bit of Hicks, and now we're going to get right to our discussion with Dr. Kilcrease.
Milbank is interesting to me because what he, I think, does a good job showing is that really in theology and maybe the last 200 years, both, like we might say, liberal or conservative theology, that the existence of the idea of the secular has really profoundly distorted how we think about God and about truth and things like that. In the early modern period, following the 30 Years' War, you have a kind of construction of reality where there's this public realm and then there's this private realm, and religion and value are sort of consigned to the private realm, and the public realm, the realm of objectivity, is the realm of secular science, and then also kind of a rights-based theory of government. And this is viewed as just sort of being neutral, and, you know, when you strip away the irrational lens, I guess you could say, of religion, then that's what you get. But what he, I think, really does a very good job of showing is that secularity itself is not simply neutral and value-free. It is itself its own, it's a constructed worldview in and of itself, and that because of that, there's no particular reason why Christian theology has to operate under the assumption that, you know, secular modernity is just sort of, you know, a neutral arbitrator of what's real and what's not real. Now, how does this distort Christian theology? Well, I mean, in the case of liberal theology, basically, whatever variety of liberal theology you're talking about says, okay, well, the reality that secularity gives us, that's the neutral, true reality. So let's kind of adjust our theology and give up some articles of the faith. But, okay, here's where the line is. Past this line, this is really the heart of Christianity. We won't give anything up past this line. And the line is different if you're Schleiermacher or Ritschl than if you're Karl Barth or Reinhold Niebuhr. But basically, that's how it works. On the conservative end of things, I would say that there is a tendency to assume, again, that secular canons of rationality and knowledge are the real deal, but then claim that you essentially can prove pre-modern theology using it, right? So I can think of a number of Christian apologists who I think kind of give the farm away too much, saying that you know, science and empiricism and things like that are simply a universal you know, neutral discourse, and but don't worry, you know, because we can, you know, prove our you know, conservative theology, whatever it would be, conservative Lutheran or Reformed or whatever theology, correct using these tools, which ironically, in many cases, were ways of construing knowledge invented specifically to undermine Christian theology. So So in that regard, I think Milbank is helpful. Some of the things I don't find helpful, I mean his program, I mean, he's an Anglo-Catholic, and obviously I'm not an Anglo-Catholic. And for him, the church is like this sort of romantic, organic community that he's sort of trying to return to, very much in the way that the people in the Oxford movement were interested in constructing a kind of, I guess you could say, romantic, organic community in the face of the rise of, you know, capitalism and sort of atomistic senses of individualism. I mean, for me, again, what would be central, of course, is the church is a community that gathers around the forgiveness of sins, not just sort of this alternative community, which he seems to have a very strong view of. I mean, there's also things. I mean, he's a theologian and not a historian, and so I think that his way of construing the development of Western thought, particularly the entire debate in the late Middle Ages of univocity of being versus the analogy of being, is quite wrong. And I've actually written on that a little bit. I mean, I guess this would just be a few of the things that I would find problematic with him. Also his ultimate solution, that since sort of post-structuralism says that you know, we can't go behind the signifier to the signified. That is to say, language is a kind of grid through which we view all of reality, and there's no going around it to look at naked reality, so to speak. So in the case of the post-structuralists, they say, well, what's really behind it is just, you know, a gray mass of what Derrida calls difference. And what Milbank says is, okay, well, that's true. If we can't get past language, why not just say how Christians narrate reality, so to speak, is like the real reality. I mean, there's no going behind it to verify that that's the case, but we can just say that that is the case. We can just assert it is, and then because we're telling a better story, we can out narrate postmodernism. Well, first of all, I think there are ways of testing language, and of course also one wonders, Alistair McGrath actually brings this up in his second volume of his book about the theology of science, where he's kind of critiquing Milbank. He says, okay, well, where did the Christian idiom come from? If you can't go around it to talk about reality apart from, you know, your language game and your meta-narrative, I mean, where does this come from? It has to actually be based on, you have to be able to say that there were extra-linguistic realities that cause, we might say, the Christian narrative and Christian discourse in the first place. So, I mean, like, I don't know, the resurrection. I'm a little bit suspicious of that line of argumentation. And again, it's a very Catholic one, too, because what he says, we'll out-narrate. We're telling a better story, and so it's part of this kind of argument that Catholics make about the evidential power of beauty, which I find extremely suspicious myself. But anyways.
Yeah. No, I have read Milbank and reread many of the sections, especially his final chapter, you know, where he kind of comes to some conclusions. I laughed when I read through all of that and got to the first line of his final chapter, where he said, "No, I did all that to make this assertion," right at the end there. And then, you know, he kind of puts forth his program. You know, I, like you, do see many of the problems that postmodernity identified with modernity, and I agree with the analysis of the problems. Where I diverge is the solution to those problems, and how we can, you know, kind of push forth, knowing the problems that exist in both camps of philosophy. So that's the major problem I have with, again, I agree with you, the Enlightenment project is not value free. It claims objectivity, but really at the end of the day, ideas have to originate somewhere. They have to, you know, originate with a subject, and without God, nothing can truly be objective. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where I just really part ways with, you know, anybody who's going to take a postmodern approach, including Milbank's, to say, well,
You know, as you said, you know, we're just going to out narrate you. We're going to have a better story, a more historical story, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, and that's kind of, you know, my experience at Claremont was, you know, this is what finally, you know, kind of brought it all together for me and why I like Hicks. Because when I came, I mean, he wrote, you know, kind of predates me quite a bit as far as my education goes. But my experience with folks who kind of operate, you know, in that ethos of philosophy that, you know, the story is the thing, and whoever can tell the best stories is the winner or what have you. You know, what ends up happening is they end up coming up with the same story, which is ultimately, you know, some sort of political program that includes socialism. That boils down to trying to reach, you know, as I well, I don't know if Hicks actually puts it this way, but the way I kind of boil it down to is their story is, you know, they want to put something, a story together that's going to drive us towards this egalitarian utopia.
Well, I would say egalitarianism seems to be the thing. I mean, I think that Hicks overplays the economic aspect of the argument. But yeah, I mean, you're certainly right that egalitarianism is, for whatever reason, well, I think I know the reason. It's simply in a kind of unchallenged.
Yeah.
Well, and that's so anyone who asserts power relations in any way whatsoever, doesn't matter that you actually, if you think about it, it's illogical to think you could get away from power relations.
Right.
You know, is somehow involved in some kind of covert play. Now, certainly people do abuse the authority which we might say God has established within creation, but it doesn't necessarily mean that any claim to authority necessarily means an abuse of that authority, I wouldn't say. So.
Right. I agree. And that's, you know, and that's the problem I have with the Enlightenment folks is that authority piece. You know, we need that authority to be outside of us. That's why we need God philosophically, in my opinion. You know, just from a purely philosophical argument, because if we can't locate authority, then what we end up doing is fighting over that amongst ourselves. Well, you know, who has the best program? Do the Enlightenment liberals have the best program, or do the postmodern socialists have the best program? You know, and then
right.
and nary the twain shall meet, because there's no way to objectively you know, have a third party come in and say, okay guys, here's the program. You know, so so that's, you know, that's I, like Hicks, came to the conclusion, you know, politically that the agenda is set such that we use, you know, post-structuralism on culture in order to drive toward this egalitarianism. Now, there was a couple of camps even at Claremont. There was one camp who was, yes, let's do the egalitarian thing. And there was another camp that said, no, we'll never achieve that. We're just going to end up flip-flopping power. So take the race issue, for instance. That was a big one when I was there. You know, well, you've got guys like James Cone who are black nationalists. You know, we had the what we called the Xers, the Malcolm Xers, the James Cone types. And then we had the homogenized version of Martin Luther King Jr. folks. You know, you had those two camps, you know, kind of battling that out. But the idea was, we're trying to, you know, achieve equality for all, and particularly economically speaking, they were talking about equality of outcomes. And so, you know, so you're ultimately talking about socialism. And then within that, you've got several camps. You've got communists, which that's where I would put Milbank, is in the communist camp, where, you know, we're living in this egalitarian community where everybody has their role, and there's, you know, the individual is subsumed into the community, you know, for him,
it goes back to his what he calls the metaphysics of participation rather than metaphysics of violence. So.
Yeah.
Foundation, going back to his contention about late medieval philosophy, for him, the idea is, okay, so you have a universal reality, let's say, I don't know, a square, And so in Platonism, which then Augustine and other people, Aquinas, take over, all individual squares participate in the reality of that square. It's not like squareness is somehow imposed upon them. They have their identity because of participation. And so for him, then that translates into a social system where an authority above doesn't somehow violently, let's say, impose order on people. Rather, if you leave people to themselves, essentially, and their relationships are not hampered by sin, that they'll simply, I guess you could say, participate in the common reality of their society. And so for him, he has all these very strange ideas about the medieval guild system, where people kind of collectively, you know, agree to participate in this common, you know, economic enterprise and decide amongst themselves what to make. And I mean, of course, that was absolutely not what it was like. But really, I mean, he's a romantic. His wife is a Tolkien scholar, and he has very like romantic ideas about the Middle Ages. And then, of course, you get nominalism, where nominalism is okay. Everything is roped into a common category because what we might, with our mental concepts, kind of, I guess, because they violently impose squareness on a whole class of entities called squares. And so God, too, of course, violently, I guess you could say, imposes by an act of will, on his creation, you know, arbitrarily making decisions like, you know, friendship is good and murder is evil or something like that.
Right.
And so then he thinks that translates into the wars between the conciliarists and then the papalists in the late Middle Ages, which is completely absurd. Right, because the church can't just organically hold together, right?
Yeah.
You have to violently impose authority from above, and with the conciliarists, it's like an aggregate of all individuals, and with the papalists, it's just a one person violently. So, anyways, though he's an Anglo-Catholic, he absolutely hates the idea of the papacy for this reason.
Okay? Sure.
So I wouldn't describe him as a communist. I mean, he definitely has sort of leftist leanings. He's even mentioned in some of his writings how he's voted, I think, for the British Green Party at some point. But he actually doesn't even really like the secular state. I mean, certain statements he's made, really at the end of Theology and Social Theory, he actually actively just sort of sounds like a Christian anarchist at some point. So,
right. Well, but the reason I would, you know, again, it's difficult because I'm placing these secular categories on a man who utterly rejects secular categories. So, so you know, I'll own that piece. But the reason I think he best fits in that category is because that was one of Marx's big contentions, was eventually, you know, we wouldn't even need government.
It's true that he did believe it would be a state of anarchy in the end. But I think Milbank conceives it a little bit different. It's more he wants to go back to something rather than go forward to something.
That makes sense. And again, I think his communism is nuanced, highly nuanced. But again, he's not a fascist. I mean, he's certainly not that. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, he's not looking for, you know, a top down type of socialism. He's definitely not a democratic socialist. He's not looking for that kind of thing. You know, that's way too individualistic for him. So I just don't know where else to put him, you know, as far as, you know, just trying to get a, you know.
Well, I don't really think he fits into, like, normal, I mean, categories, again, of in terms of the political spectrum. One connection I find with him very interesting is if you look at how Anglo-Catholicism emerged in the mid-19th century, it was basically at the tail end of, or the beginning of, the Whig Party, sort of promoting capitalism and sort of individualism and all this sort of thing. And there was a desire, of course, to reform the Church of England by eliminating a number of bishoprics, and so they revolted against this, essentially. And so they were interested then in not in individualism, but kind of moving back again to sort of this romantic kind of organic community that they felt that they had lost from in kind of the post-French revolutionary world. And when does Milbank write Theology and Social Theory? Well, he writes it in 1990 at the tail end of Thatcherism. So we have neoliberalism essentially in ascendancy in Britain. And so he's essentially, I think, kind of rejecting that in the way that some of the people in the Oxford movement had problems with, you know, the Whig Party and the sort of utilitarianism and things like that going on.
Right, there. Right. Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's my big, I mean, and he talks about coercion a little bit, which was surprising toward the end there. He talks about, you know, okay, well, how are we going to get, you know, the kind of, as you put it, how are we going to get the squares to fulfill their squareness? and he mentions coercion of some sort. You know, it's kind of like a kinder, gentler type of coercion, but somebody steps...
Coercion is the misery of being failing to participate, right? So in fact, that's how he views God's punishment, though I think that a few passages in the Old Testament might suggest otherwise. failure to participate is itself simply the punishment. Because the participation is presumably like the fulfillment of your true nature, I guess. So,
right. Right.
I mean, it's a much more Neoplatonic view of God than another criticism of McGrath of him is that there's really no. It's all very Platonic. I mean, it's not. I mean, he certainly utilizes things like the doctrine of the Trinity and the Incarnation. He believes in these things, and he's an Orthodox Christian in that regard. But he there's not really a sustained engagement with the Bible at all. Which
right.
Is,
right.
A bit
yeah.
Problematic. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing that I kept kind of grasping around for was, okay, you know, what direction is he coming from here? You know, when he talks about, you know, I've heard him in some of his lectures talk about faith and reason. And I'm going, okay, what does he mean by faith precisely? Where does that stem from? Does it stem, you know, from your imagination, from your emotions, you know, what your experiences, your lived experience? And the best I could come up with really was, I mean, I see a lot of Whitehead in him. Do you detect that? Or are you that familiar with Whitehead? I mean, this is all we got at Claremont was Whitehead. So maybe I see Whitehead in everything.
No, I know Whitehead. I don't really find a lot of Whitehead in him. I mean, okay. I guess there's a Platonic connection.
Yeah.
I mean, Whitehead was very, you know, much of a Platonist in some ways. But yeah, I could see that connection.
Right, right. So
I would say that he would have a very typically Tom. He's a very big fan of Thomism. I would think he would have very, you know, I think he would believe in, he would hold to a, no, I mean, I know this from his other writings, he would certainly hold to the idea of infused grace, and he would certainly believe that faith is created in you by the infusion of faith in your baptism, and that the content of the faith, though, I would say that for him, is mediated to you by the organic historical community of the
right,
church, understood
right.
along
okay.
the lines of the branch theory.
Yep.
I mean, I would say that one of the reasons why he's not interested in directly engaging in the Bible, he mentions this when he's talking about Spinoza at one point, is that he considers direct engagement with the Bible a kind of historicist thing,
right?
And that the Bible itself actually takes on meaning over time by its being used by the Christian community, which is, of course, guided by the Holy Spirit. So right. Newman's idea of the development of doctrine would be really important, I think, for him.
Right,
so,
right, right, right. Yeah. So again, you know, you kind of, you know, Whitehead's, you know, really, I would say, Hegelian schema, you know, where you've got a process going on, and then it comes into contact with another process, and then there's, you know, kind of this realization that something's going on, and this infinite number of possibilities that could happen via this interaction between these two processes, and then the decision. So that, you know, the thesis, antithesis, and the resolution of those to synthesis. You know, that the process is the thing. You know, for. It seems to me like, you know, really, as far as, you know, these communities coming together and working, you know, on the ground toward, you know, this egalitarianism in community and that sort of thing. So, yeah. So at any rate, my concern. Seems like a political agenda that worries me, because it just seems like every time something like this is tried, it turns out not to go so well. Something happens, especially when you get it beyond a small, commune or even within a small commune, stuff, you know, can turn violent very quickly, because it just seems like, you know, us in our sinful state will always grasp for power, and if there's a power vacuum, then that's always going to result in violence. And that's where politically I would completely disagree with him to say that, you know, you're going to achieve more peace going with his program than you're going to achieve going with a liberal capitalist program. There's just no historical evidence of that.
Yes, I mean, I would agree. I mean, part of the problem too is that I don't think he really means to ever enact anything like this. I think that he, much like all of his romantic ideas about the church, I don't know what church he's even talking about. I mean, these are abstractions for him,
yeah,
and ideals, but they don't have a lot to do with him actually ever trying to, I think,
right,
enact anything like this.
If you got
rid of the secular state, it would just be anarchy, though he claims again that this is just a byproduct of our belief that we have to have a secular state to protect us from one another. Well, I mean, I think there's fairly ample historical evidence that we do need a secular state to protect us from one another.
Right.
So,
yeah, unfortunately. Go ahead.
Yes. No, that's fine. I was done.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. So, that's the thing is, you know, I guess, you know, I've listened to as many lectures as I could get my hands on of his, and of course read the book. He doesn't seem like much of a political actor.
He's interested in metaphysics is what he's interested in.
Right, right. But that's the thing is, like, you know, all my colleagues at Claremont, you know, you hand something like this off to them, you know, that's the folks that go out there and try to kind of enact this sort of thing, especially in the culture, and perhaps politically, you know, they might become a politician of some manner, that whole project, you know, of trying to achieve, you know, really economic and social equality and outcomes, this egalitarianism. I think that's a big problem we're experiencing in our culture, you know, especially when it comes, you know, I think the big point of attack, I mean, it started with words. I mean, if you want to, you know, dismantle Western civilization as we know it, you know, start monkeying around with our literature, our texts, you know, that have, you know, brought us to this point, namely Holy Scripture, and then start attacking the family, start to piece by piece dismantle that. And you know, that's precisely what I see going on, you know, in our culture, is people who have been educated in this way and have learned of ideas like this have taken them into culture and politics, and they in my opinion will prove to be very destructive to individuals and our culture and society and that sort of thing. So all that to say is ideas have consequences, I guess, would be my concern. Yeah, that's how I view postmodernism. You know, that's my understanding of it, is that, and again, why I resonate with Hicks is because it's fascinating. Every postmodern I end up engaging, you know, postmodern philosopher I end up engaging with, or somebody who knows what they're doing with you know, post-structuralism and the postmodern ethos, they end up coming to the same conclusions, you know, as far as what culture should look like. It was really telling. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a religion prof in Oregon, and actually Washington, I think, in Washington. And we were talking about homosexuality, and I said, mm-hmm. Look, would you tolerate me saying that I believe homosexuality is immoral? And he said, no, I would not tolerate that. And you know, because we were talking about tolerance and we were talking about these issues, and I said, you know, that really was a seminal moment for me, because, and again, at Claremont, it was, you know, there were certain you know, almost commandments type of things, you know, certain axioms that you just did not violate. Mm-hmm. And they all came to the same, you know, politically, culturally, they're all coming to the exact same conclusions. Whereas with you know, if you take postmodernism just on its face, really you're never going to, you know, that's one mistake I think Milbank makes, is it drives at this nihilism. And I don't think it ever does. I don't think that's the project of the postmodernism. So I didn't think, it certainly wasn't of Foucault, in my opinion.
Well, I mean, you can't really escape meaning. I think he would kind of agree with that. But I think that he would say that, like he says, it's a degeneration from the original nominalist project into what he would call arbitrariness and violence. So that, I mean, it's difficult, I mean, to prioritize one, we might say, set of power relations over other sets of power relations, or one narration of reality over other ones. So.
Right. Right,
you just violently impose it upon reality.
Okay,
so I wanted to mention Hicks to you.
Sure.
So, I mean, do you? One thing that I found very interesting about him was what you call the Randian subtext. So, I mean, he's obviously a founder of full of Rand. I mean, if you go to his website, he's got all kinds of things about objectivism.
Sure.
So, for him, postmodernism emerges from Kant, and Kant is somehow an anti-Enlightenment figure, although he wrote the famous essay, What is Enlightenment? Mm-hmm. And so the irrationality that Kant is apparently trying to protect from reason is religion, which is a very Randian idea.
Yep.
Even though Kant actually wasn't tremendously religious, he thought praying was pathetic, wouldn't participate in public religious services, even though he was rector of the University of Königsberg, things like this.
Right.
And so then now the new irrationality is socialism. So again, good Randian understanding. So science, which apparently is in conflict with religion, is the reason why Kant felt he needed to protect religion. He had to protect it from science. And then socialism failed, so then to protect socialism from reason, people had to come up with postmodernism, though I don't think he documented that all that particularly well myself. And then, of course, we end with Nietzsche in the Genealogy of Morals, as I predicted it was going to end there, which, again, is where Rand kind of steals her idea that there are these really awesome people in society who are like high achievers, and then everybody else kind of gangs up on them and, you know, attacks them and tries to make them into big losers, essentially, as they are. So so that was interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a fundamentally kind of a Randian. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of his historiography. I don't think of Kant as an anti-Enlightenment figure, and not least because, how are you defining Enlightenment? I mean, there's multiple Enlightenments. And if you're going to kind of go the Peter Gay direction of claiming that, like, the French Enlightenment, like, is the Enlightenment, I guess you could say that Kant is sort of different than that. But, I mean, he's very much a thorough rationalist.
Yeah.
So I would say that. And I don't think that he's really trying to protect faith exactly. I think he really just is working with Hume's recognition that there are limitations to reason, and trying to apply essentially the implications of that idea. I mean, I guess that's be my take on it.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on there, Dr. Kilcrease. I mean, that's the thing. The big thing that hung with me from Hicks was politically and culturally, while postmodernism would contend that we should have all these disparate ideas, that there's really no meaning, they come up with this really concrete set of meanings for politics, economics, and culture, and they all line up. I mean, it's almost a monolith of subjects that they converge on via postmodern philosophy. That's what really why I would say, yeah, you know, Hicks is my guy. Now, I can't. I mean, to say that I can't stand Ayn Rand is a little strong, but it's close. Because again, I have the same problems you do with Hicks' conclusions. You know, what do we do about this? Well, we've got to jettison religion, for sure. And we've certainly got to guard against, Marxism, And you know, and his contention is that post-structuralism was another attempt to revive Marxism, which I'm too am fuzzy on his historiography there. I'm not sure I follow. You know, he makes all those connections very well, but at the same time, I think the conclusion stands. I mean, there's still, you know, the goal of socialism, of Marxism, is, you know, egalitarianism. And so, what's the goal of postmodernism? Well, it's egalitarian. It's equity of outcomes in economics and in culture, and so on and so forth. And so I think in that sense it is a revival of that idea. Again, this classic battle, you know, well, classic, you know, over the past 500 years are you a socialist or are you a liberal? You know, that battle still rages, I think, between the modernists and the postmodernists. And the only way out of it, that's one reason, I think one way I would say to put it in Lutheran terms, that I was brought back to the faith because I just didn't see any way out of this mess other than to have an outside authority say, okay, guys, this is what's going on. And within that, I see within Christianity, I see the freedom to govern ourselves, in the least violent way possible. Which again, I would contend is liberal capitalist, polity and economic structure. So again, the whole objection, I have many, many problems with the whole objectivist approach, because at the end of the day, when you get right down to it, when you boil down all that stuff to its ontology, it has to be objective. I mean, these values have to arise from somewhere, from someone. Not a one of them have I ever heard, Sam Harris is probably the most popular one, trying to derive is from ought, you know, and he can never make that connection, never makes that connection. And what it ends up boiling down to is he's looking at science and saying, okay, his basic idea for value is, well, we're going to look at science and then we're going to try to move toward the least amount of human suffering possible. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, fine. But that value is derived from you. So it's ultimately subjective. It's not objective. You're using science to say, okay, well, we want to, but based on that is your subjective opinion that we want to reduce human suffering as much as possible. Okay. Yes.
And of course, a holdover from Christian culture as well, because it's not like the Romans could cared less about reducing human suffering.
Right. So. Right. Precisely. So that's, I mean, yeah, I the reason I don't have as big a problem with objectivists as I do postmodernists is because I can talk to an objectivist because we can reason through things and we can talk about, you know, okay, well, let's talk reason. Let's talk about the reasons why, say homosexual relationships, homosexual acts are not good for people. This doesn't promote human flourishing, or transgenderism. Why this is a bad thing for people. Let's talk about those, you know, talk about the reasons for that. You know, I think you can reason back to scripture, but ultimately you still have to have, the character of God. You know, God is love. Without, you know, that's the big question I always hear in the debates is, well, you know, if all of a sudden they're, you know, if we all of a sudden discover they're absolutely without question there was no God, you know, will we all go out and murder and rape each other? And I said, my answer, and most people say, oh no, of course not. You know, you wouldn't do that. And I immediately object to that and say, if there was no God, we wouldn't be around here. Because, you talk about something like love. I mean, that flows from God's character. That's who God is, you mm-hmm. know, and that's given to us objectively from the source of him. He's the only one allowed to be subjective. so that's the only way out of that conundrum in my estimation. And so, but at least we can reason those things out. I can reason an objectivist back to the ethics of scripture, uh-huh. and then use evidence to talk about the resurrection and so on and so forth. But once I get toward the end of Hicks is when I start getting, okay, all right, now we're now we're going off the rails here, because he certainly is going to reject any kind of religion or faith out of hand as, you know, as something irrational, which I completely reject that notion. So.
Okay, so there you have it. Thank you to Dr. Kilcrease for being willing to come on the program and discuss this a little bit. Hopefully we'll he and I will continue a dialogue on these sorts of things, because I do believe that Christianity is a key component in how we can move things forward. I kind of fall in that camp that we cannot move forward with a strict objectivism or strictly the Enlightenment project. You've got to have God in these things, and we've talked about this many times here. And I mentioned it even here in my discussion with Dr. Kilcrease, is these two sides are warring, and we need an arbiter on this thing. We need a third party who knows what they're talking about, and that would be God. And philosophically, I think that's definitely necessary. And then you add to the fact that God is real, and the existence of God. We have God as Christians. And not just as Christians, but God is ontologically exists. It's not some sort of fantasy or pie in the sky or spaghetti monster type of idea. God exists, all praise to Him be, because we need this third party arbiter. Because again, like I said in the discussion with Dr. Kilcrease, the nary the twain shall meet between these two parties. We need an authoritative outside party, a genuinely objective party to settle these things. Well, at any rate, again, thanks to Dr. Kilcrease for coming on the program and discussing these things. Please don't forget to give your $50 to the Kenya Well Project and also buy some Kenyan Christian art. Also, don't forget to listen to us on Pirate Christian Radio and also KNNA The Cross in Nebraska. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week.
Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. It brings salvation to those who believe. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. Tell me I'm a sinner and Christ died for me. I don't want to know about what you did last week on your summer vacation, what you saw, where you went, or how much it cost. Instead, won't you tell me all the words that give me salvation? How He lived and how He died for me on the cross. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. Give me the good news of God's only Son. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. Give me the